because it is really hard, and you want to say, can I with integrity remain within this denomination that seems hell-bent on embracing heresy and sexual immorality? Now, I think there are a number of ways that people will be thinking through that question for themselves.
Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the head of national ministries for the FIEC, and I'm here with Ros Clark, who works for the Church Society. Ros, tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all.
Hi, I'm Ros. Why is that the hardest question in the world to answer? I'm Associate Director for Church Society.
Would you like me to tell you about yourself?
Yes.
Well, this is Ros. You are something director. I just missed that. Associate Director for the Church Society, which is an Anglican society. But tell us what the Church Society... That's an easier question. What does the Church Society do?
Yeah, we are a fellowship contending to reform and renew the Church of England in biblical faith, which, as you may imagine, right now is quite a difficult task. We have a lot on our hands. We do a range of different things. We publish a lot of books, magazine, quarterly theological journal. We have a podcast. We also run conferences. We have a thing called patronage of a number of Church of England parishes, which means that we have an involvement in the appointments process for those places. And we have a sort of political wing as well, engaging not so much with national politics, but with Church of England
politics. That all sounds quite sinister, but I'm sure it's not. Now, we are here in Keswick.
Beautiful Keswick.
It is beautiful Keswick. In fact, I can look out of that window and see Latrig and the sun shining in November. It's very cold.
Yes, very I don't know the names of these mountains, but I also have mountains.
Okay, no doubt someone would tell us in the know. I don't think you and I are about to be climbing up Latrig this afternoon, are we? Just tell us a little bit about what we're doing here.
Yeah. So this is the Keswick Identity Workshop. It's an event over 3 days with a whole range of different kinds of contributors helping us think about this whole issue of identity, particularly around gender and sexuality. So we've had some input helping us understand the cultural situation, the theological issues that are around this, some medical, some legal, some pastoral, all sorts of different contributions to help us understand the issues better and maybe be able to communicate better about this in different contexts.
And we don't all agree, I think it's fair to say. There are some points of difference that we've got to work through and think about. This is kind of a new... it is a new area and it's not a new area. Both at the same time.
Yeah, we've
always had bodies, and Christians always have been thinking about bodies. But I think the particular sharpness to us at the moment, is that fair enough?
I think that's right. I mean, I think there probably have always been a very small number of people with struggles around their gender and their body, but it's certainly been a huge increase in that for a number of sort of sociological, cultural kind of reasons, psychological reasons. And I think, you know, you said we don't all agree, and some of that's true. I think we don't all quite agree completely about the sort of underlying theology, but we certainly... Because people are coming from such different approaches, whether, you know, medical or pastoral or counselling or whatever, this sort of forum where actually we can see how those different things are working together or perhaps not always working together that well is really helpful to be
and
able
more
to
that we agree on,
have those conversations. Totally.
That we disagree on.
Totally.
So, for example, we're talking about, you know, in the context of same-sex relationships, talking about lust, we all agree about sin and the nature of it, which kind of brings us on to the reason for chatting today. Mm. Back in June, we talked to Lee, who's your boss, I think, is
that's
that right?
That's right, Lee Gatiss, yeah.
I call him my Lord
Bishop. You
can
Bishop call me for, Dr. Ros anytime you like.
Okay, I will... Well, I'm just about to say, I feel we've traded up, Ros, by having you today.
Thanks.
So you can pass that on to Lee. I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that news. So we had a little update on the Church of England. There was a vote that had not long happened in Synod. You're a member of the General Synod, actually.
I am a member of the General Synod, yes.
There's obviously been another vote.
Yes.
So without getting bogged down in Anglican politics, or indeed canon law, which just leaves me slightly cold. I think it leaves most people slightly cold.
It does. We're very fortunate to have some people who really properly understand that
indeed
stuff.
Yeah, well, we want to ask you and this is really a podcast obviously for FIC leaders, other independent church leaders listening to it, we want to know A, what's going on, and B, how we can pray and support ministry maids. And also, I've got some kind of slightly awkward questions that I feel that I can ask you, to know you a little bit, and you've said you'll be willing to answer, which perhaps some of our listeners will feel, I can't ask my vicar down the road that. He's bruised and battered, I can see that.
Yeah.
So I don't want to kick him while he's down and ask him difficult questions.
Make him feel worse.
So I'm going to ask him some difficult questions.
Great. Well, should we start with what's happened?
Let's start with the synod. Yeah. Let's go for it.
So, as you may remember, in February, General Synod voted for a motion, the motions themselves are so vague.
Yes, but when you read them, you think, actually, what has been voted for? I'm never quite sure.
Absolutely. So in February, it was basically...
Is that half a course in terms of motions?
It can be, but it is one of the issues is whether it's the right kind of motion this sort of thing under canon law, which I won't go into.
Thank you. But anyway, in February, we basically
said to the bishops who had produced these prayers to bless same-sex relationships, yeah, that's great. But you'll need to, you know, have a go at sort of revising it, and some bits are not very clear. And also it will need to come with pastoral guidance on how and when these are to be used, which is obviously very important in understanding what something means is the context in which it is supposed to be applied.
Course,
yeah. So a lot of the prayers, in fact, are just taken from our common worship marriage service.
Right.
In the context of the marriage service, completely fine. In the context of a same-sex blessing, less so. So they were supposed to produce that, and they were also going to do some work on what they call pastoral reassurance, which is to say, for those of us who don't welcome the prayers of love and faith, who won't be performing these things in our churches, how will we be reassured that we can still continue in our ministry, that we'll have appropriate episcopal oversight from our bishops, and so on. So they were supposed to do all of that by July. They didn't. In July, we were told they would do it all by...
What did you say they were supposed to do?
The bishops.
And every bishop or a subset?
The House of Bishops are responsible for this. The House of Bishops is all of the diocesan bishops, so the main bishop in each diocese, and a handful of others.
Okay.
So not everyone who is called a bishop is part of that,
but
the main body. And so they promised that they would bring all this back to Synod in July. They didn't. So then they said, right, we'll have to have an extra synod in November.
This wasn't planned.
There's always sort of dates allowed for a November synod, but it's extremely rare that they actually use them. So they said, no, we'll have to come back in November and we'll talk about it then. So we got to November and what they had produced sort of prior to that was a statement from the House of Bishops again that they were going to go ahead and commend the prayers of love and faith, very lightly edited from the original version.
Okay. So basically as it was.
More or less as it was, exactly. And that the motion they were going to bring to Synod was that we would recognise the progress they've made and encourage them to carry on. So again, bland and meaningless.
Yeah, you wonder what that does mean.
Exactly.
Presumably to some people that's a permission, and to other people that's a denial.
Right. I
can see that if I had a church meeting and I proposed a motion like that, I would probably get torn down.
It is extraordinary. This is slightly off topic, but it's literally a motion saying, tell us we're doing a great job.
Yeah.
Which didn't go down brilliantly in Synod this time.
I should think there's probably no one who thinks they are doing a great job on whatever side of the debate.
And so what that allows is we had 10 hours allocated to debate this motion, and effectively we spent most of the time debating what are called the amendments to the motion that people put in. And so we did have amendments which were, we just want to take out the word progress because we don't really think you've made any. But there were much more substantive amendments as well, the most significant of which added to the motion and asked the bishops to consider also commending standalone services of same-sex blessing.
That's more than have been talked about
right,
before.
So previously what they'd said is, here are some prayers, which bishops are always able to commend prayers. For example, they would commend a prayer for use at the coronation of a new king.
Or after the queen died. Or
a specific circumstance. It doesn't need to go in a prayer book, but here's something that we think is a great prayer for you to use. So they've got the power to do that, and that's what they said they were going to do, was that these prayers would be allowed in your Sunday service, your normal Sunday service, you would be allowed to pray them. They had received a lot of legal advice around this, about what they were allowed to do without it becoming an actual change in the doctrine of the Church of England, which requires a different process.
Right.
And their legal advice, as far as we know, had originally been understood to mean that was okay. But if you have an actual service, like you have a separate wedding service, then that would indicate a change of doctrine.
Mm. That does look very different.
Right.
Although exactly. Arguably, they're all different.
It's a little bit splitting hairs.
Yeah.
But, you know, at that point, you've got a special service and there's stuff in the paperwork about can you wear a wedding dress for that? And, you know, all this sort of stuff.
The vicar or the bride? Sorry, I couldn't. That was below the belt. I do apologise.
Absolutely. You know, you're allowed to get out your white lacy frock anytime you like in the Church of England. So that was the most substantive amendment, and that was passed by a margin.
Who proposed that?
The Bishop of Oxford.
So one of the bishops who was part of the discussion proposed to basically take it further.
Yes, and in fact, the Bishop of London, who was the one actually proposing the motion, because although it comes from
Sarah
the
Lally.
Whole House, it has to be one person in her name. She told us in her sort of introductory speech that she was in favour of the Oxford Amendment as well, and the Archbishops of York and Canterbury also indicated that they were in favour of the Oxford Amendment.
A bit underhand. You know, let's agree on something together and then let's undermine it.
Yes.
When it comes, is that a fair assessment?
I think it is a fair assessment. It was very hard to see how, in the paperwork we were given supporting the motion, we were being told that the legal advice didn't allow for them to go ahead with this. But then bishops who had seen the legal advice, which most of us hadn't, were suggesting that we could go ahead with this. And the House of Clergy and the House of Laity, we're sort of like the Houses of Parliament.
Right, three layers.
Three layers, exactly, like the Lords and the Commons. House of Clergy, House of Laity had not had sight of any of this legal advice. We couldn't evaluate for ourselves whether it was supporting or not supporting these things.
Blind,
yeah, we were being asked to trust the bishops who could not themselves agree on what was appropriate to do. So one of the things that was very noticeable this time in November is that all of the votes were very much closer, but particularly in the House of Bishops, there was real disagreement. About a third of the bishops voted against the motion that had come from the House of Bishops.
So a change in doctrine requires a much larger vote. It looks like that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Exactly. You would require a two-thirds majority for a change in liturgy and a change in doctrine.
It doesn't feel like there's the appetite for that right now.
There's no point going for that right now. I mean, even these votes, which only have to get a strict majority of 50%, they're being lost and won by a couple of votes here and there either side. It's very, very close. So in the end, what we agreed was an amended version of the original motion that does allow for the bishops to consider commending these standalone services.
So they haven't actually commended them.
So nothing has been commended yet. Okay. So if you say what has happened? Nothing has yet happened. We're told,
and yet everything.
We're told that the prayers themselves are going to be commended in December, so we're expecting that in a couple of weeks' time. I think it's very unlikely that the standalone services will also be commended at that point, because although there are drafts of them, they will need to do some work actually putting the liturgy of all of that together. They may commend it in January after the House of Bishops meeting then, or they may wait till February Synod and we'll have to talk about it all again and then say, yeah, bishops, do whatever you want. If I had to summarise what we did in November, we have, by a very small majority, agreed to give bishops licence to do whatever they want.
Right.
That's I think, where we're at.
Is it unfair to invoke the slippery slope argument? I mean, it does feel like it's always difficult to go back on things, isn't it?
It's very difficult to go back on things. So one of the things that would, I think, well, that we have been told, and I think would have to happen at some point, is that the standalone services could only really be commended under an experimental rubric, and at some point would have to have formal agreement. We've been told in 2025, which I think is a date chosen because Justin Welby will retire very shortly after that, and he wants to try and get it done before then. I cannot see how they hope to get the two-thirds majority by then. It will be the same people. We won't have had any elections by then. You know, there'll be slight changes here and there, but I don't see how they will get that sort of significant shift.
But if you've got a service that you can use on an experimental basis.
Right. And so, but if we then vote against it, So that service that people have been using for 2 years is suddenly no longer authorised. I don't know what you do with that. The genie is out of the bottle, but also legally the genie won't be out of the bottle. We were hearing in November a lot of stories from people talking about how they've been breaking effectively the law on this for years with the full knowledge of
their... famously. Yeah. Suddenly announced, now he stepped down as a vicar, that actually he did have a marriage service.
Exactly.
And he saw someone conducted a marriage service for him and his husband. He had a wedding, didn't he? He was married to his
Yes, and you know, same sex blessings have been happening all over the place. We know some started happening after February. I don't know, but I think it will be fair to say it'll be chaos.
Right. Yeah, just in case people are still listening, that may not be the case. I'm slightly overwhelmed with canon law. Quick fire questions. Aren't the Liberals doing this anyway?
A lot of them. Not all of them. Some have real integrity, but a lot of them are.
Okay. So they, you know, those who are really pursuing an agenda for the Church of England to conduct same-sex weddings, which would require a change in the law.
Mm. It would, yes. That's UK law, not just church law.
Yeah. So those who are pursuing this, are they disappointed by what's happened, or do they just see it as another stepping stone along the way? I mean, Jane O'Zan sounds as though she's thrown the toys out of the pram a little bit. But.
Well, she has. I mean, Jane O'Zan is a law unto herself, I think. But yes, people are really, really cross. And I think not without reason. I think a lot of people thought in February it was all done and dusted.
Yeah, okay.
And they are very frustrated, very cross that actually...
There's been a bit of can-kicking.
There's been a lot of can-kicking that actually... You know, it has been restated. The doctrine of Church of England on marriage has not changed, and therefore sex is still only appropriate within heterosexual marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't really know who would want a service of blessing on their relationship on condition that they understand that their relationship is sinful or celibate. Exactly. I mean, I don't really know who's crying out for that.
No, no.
So there's a lot of sort of double-facedness, I think, having to go on.
Okay, second quick fire question.
Yeah.
I thought Welby was an evangelical. What's going on?
Yes.
There?
I mean, he certainly was converted in an evangelical sort of stable, was involved at HTB for many years. As far as I know, and I don't know him well personally, I've met him, but as far as I know, trusts in the Lord Jesus and seeks to understand scripture and apply it. I think he is in a role where he is not well equipped to cope with the pressure that is constantly on him.
I mean, he's in a management role, really, isn't he?
He is in a management role. He does get pressure from Parliament and the sort of establishment.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very
and Chris
much
Bryant has been
part of
very
that.
Vociferous in the House of Commons.
Right, and Ben Bradley and others.
Yeah.
He's also, I think, facing pressure from a lot of the bishops to do what they want him to do, or to allow them to do what they want to do.
Does he have ultimate authority? Or?
Well... He,
is there a quick answer to that? Because there isn't.
I mean, yes
send,
and no.
Send me a link to a long paper.
I'm going to say he has ultimate authority in the way the king has ultimate authority.
Okay. So the House of Bishops are collegiate in that, essentially.
Yes, so it is very much like Parliament.
Okay.
He doesn't quite sign royal assent, but he is one among many.
But if 75% of the bishops wanted one thing and he didn't, he
can't just overrule.
Okay. Let's talk about... John, or indeed Joan, who happens to be a local Church of England vicar who's a good evangelical. I know them a little bit because perhaps I'm in I have a meeting with them once a month, or I see them around, and perhaps we may be slightly different tribes of evangelical, but we both believe the gospel, we're doing gospel work, we see each other every now and again. Typically, I guess, they're bruised, they're battered, they're a little bit worn down. Why are they bruised and battered and worn down? What are the pressures on an evangelical vicar in a kind of, I'm not sure there is a bog standard parish, but in a normal parish church? So sort of putting aside the oddities, maybe the proprietary chapels, or they've got their own furrow. In an ordinary parish church, what kind of pressures is the leader of that church feeling as an evangelical?
So I think here one of the things that may be really helpful for our listeners to understand is the responsibility of a parish church means that you do have some kind of partial responsibility for everyone who lives in that area,
right,
whether or not they ever turn up on your church's doorstep. Okay. So you do have to lead your congregation in a way that that ministers most effectively to your local area, knowing that at any point those people can come in and say, we want to get married in this church, okay, we want a funeral, okay, in this church, we want to have our child baptized in this church, you are our church. Mm. You know, they can write to their local newspaper or radio station or MP and say, our vicar, and you will be their vicar.
Yeah, I remember Michael Gove, a friend of mine who's a vicar in London, telling me that he'd met Michael Gove, who's in his parish, never been to church in his life since he's been there, and he was greeted with the words, oh, you're my vicar,
exactly,
at our church. It's that kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, some churches will have an actual formal civil ceremonial role as well, and be engaged in local government and those sorts of things. So there's that sort of societal pressure, cultural pressure that is very tangible. There will also be, for most, a lot of pressure from within their diocese. You know, they will have clergy colleagues in their local area, in their deanery, and their wider area in their diocese, who will just assume that everyone agrees with them, that same-sex relationships are fine. Or if they don't, they will be often alienated and poorly treated by many in the diocese, and often including the real hierarchy in the diocese, up to and including the bishop, because they don't hold those so-called progressive views. So they will feel oppressed by local culture. They will feel isolated often amongst those who should be their fellow colleagues, and they may well have a mixed congregation.
So this is interesting for me, because I was talking to a vicar of a well-known evangelical church just sort of 5-10 miles from where we live. And I was saying to him, you know, what's the deal in your church? How did the congregation feel? He said, well, a lot of them are with me, but a lot of them aren't.
Yes.
And I said, well, what I didn't understand, I knew him well enough to ask him, I said, well, you've been an evangelical church for 30 years. How is that the case? He said, well, people come and go, and people who are just Anglican rather than evangelical or even converted sometimes will come to this church just because that's what they do. And so any congregation has, in a parish church, has that kind of mixed element to it.
Very much so. I mean, in some places, slightly more than others. If you're in a big city, that's less often the case, because people have more choices and less...
You can travel to some
Exactly. But certainly in rural areas, but many smaller towns, cities, people will still feel that sense of, well, this is my parish church, therefore that's where I go, and I'm as much a part of that as anyone else. And so there is often this very mixed thing, and that can exist within the leadership of the church as well. So the PCC, the church council, anyone in the church can stand to be elected to that.
Anyone in the church or anyone in the area? I mean, could I be on the PCC of
my
local church?
So if you're in the parish, if you've lived in the parish for 6 months, you can stand, you can go on the electoral roll and stand to be elected to the PCC. If you don't live in the parish, you do have to worship in the church. So you can't just pick any church at random. But you don't have to be a regular worshipper at the church. And so you can end up, you know, many churches, you can imagine, there's not a huge, great competition to get on the PCC.
No. So I'd probably be a shoo-in, would I?
Well, you might be in some places. And so then, as a vicar, you know, not every decision has to be run past the PCC, but on an issue like this, even when we're constantly being assured it is the vicar who will have the say in whether these blessings are or these prayers are used in their church, it will be very difficult, you can imagine, in a context where there's real division about that. Okay.
The question I really want to ask John or Joan, and I'm not going to because I think it's a highly insensitive question, but I am thinking it, so help me out, is why don't you just leave?
And
actually, you know, lots of nonconformists, that has been their story. They've been within established denominations or mixed denominations, perhaps have been in the BU, perhaps, or in Methodism, and that they've just said, I can't take it anymore, I'm going. And so I'm not going to ask that question of them, because they are vulnerable. They are, you know, and I think we do need sensitivity, don't we, to say at this point, asking questions like that is not helpful.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking it.
Yeah, you totally
so,
are.
So help
and
me out
they
here.
Are probably thinking it too. They are probably thinking it too, or at least have done, because it is really hard. And you want to say, can I, with integrity, remain within this denomination that seems hell-bent on embracing heresy and sexual immorality. Now, I think there are a number of ways that, that people will be thinking through that question for themselves, one of which I think is really important to distinguish a church from a denomination. So your local church is your church.
Yes, this is music to my ears,
and,
as you know.
I'm sure. And, you know, if your local church is a place where the gospel is taught, where the gospel is taught, where the Bible is proclaimed faithfully, where truth is upheld, that is your local church and you are not in a heretical church. Do you still want to be associated with people in a denomination that is at best very mixed? Well, there are questions about that.
In my lifetime it always has been mixed, right?
And evangelicals for every generation have been faced with the question, you know, can I be ordained by this person? Is that legitimate? And so on. And
so those are not new questions.
Those are not new questions, and we know that the effectiveness of those things doesn't depend on the godliness of the person performing them. There's also the role of the Church of England bishop. Those of us who believe in bishops know that the role of the Church of England bishop is very, very, very...
I just had to get that in, because Lee Gatiss once said to me, when I said, I believe in baptism, he said, so did I. So I'm just getting in. I'm glad to hear it, Adrian.
But the role of the Church of England bishop is very, very different from what it was in, you know, first century Crete. And a lot of it is around what we would think of as temporal issues. They're the person responsible ultimately for safeguarding,
Jensen, I mean, maybe that's an extreme. Jensen says, you know, they're just administrators. Yes. Well, they're a little bit more than
that. They are more than that. So they do have a spiritual role as well. But you can certainly distinguish quite a lot of their job as something that, you know, in a secular job, you wouldn't care whether it's Christian or not who is having that sort of oversight for you. Where there is that level of spiritual oversight, that, I mean, that's where a lot of the questions are at the moment, whether there are ways of providing alternative to your diocesan bishop, and CEC, the Church of England Evangelical Council, have already announced that they are beginning informal programs of offering that kind of episcopal oversight.
And that almost sounds like, you know, this is going to be a different church down the road. Is that preparing the way for that?
I mean, that's not, I think, what anyone is aiming for.
No.
I mean, I would love it if all the liberals decided that they left and formed their own church elsewhere. It does look unlikely, but, you know, we are the historic Church of England. It is historically evangelical, reformed, Protestant. Let's try and cling on to that if we can. So anyway, I'm losing my sense of where I'm going, but there are lots of arguments around this. So one of those is, what is the denominational link? And actually, there's quite a lot of that I might feel very comfortable holding on to, even if there's some that I'm trying to work out for the way. And that's because these days, I think it's fair to say, almost every evangelical Anglican I know is properly convinced Episcopal.
Yeah, you would have gone otherwise, wouldn't you?
I think that's right. I think it's fair to say, 20 years ago...
I mean, maybe unless you're near retirement, maybe.
Yeah, right, there might be some exactly. There were one or two, I'm sure. But like 20 years ago, I think there probably were quite a lot who were fundamentally Congregationalists or Presbyterians or whatever, but ended up in the Anglican Church.
Exactly. Is really what you meant
but,
to say.
But many of those have left already. Yeah. And why wouldn't you, actually? Yeah. So people are saying because they're convinced about Anglicanism as the way of church government. But also, here's the thing. If you're a minister listening to this and you have responsibility for congregation, you have that responsibility under the Lord Jesus. If you're an Anglican vicar, you have made promises to God to care for that flock.
Yes, it's a big thing to walk away from that.
It's a big thing to walk away from that. And yes, you have made promises of canonical obedience to your bishop. That is a promise of obedience in all things lawful and honest. You may not have understood all the stuff that we were discussing earlier, but I think it's fair to say there are big questions about whether it's either lawful or honest.
And so, you know, we might look at the... we're running out of time, so I'm just going to speed you up. We might look at the overall landscape, and we might, you know the story of Melvin, now departed in glory, Melvin Tinker, who basically crossed the road, took his whole congregation with him. Is it fair to say most vicars are not in a position to be able to do that?
Right, so there are practical reasons as well, exactly. If you're in the Church of England, you will have a church building, a vicarage.
Pension.
You may well have a curate with a curate's house. There's a lot of financial and practical things.
We can't just look at one situation and say, oh, well, you could do that and you could do that. It's more complicated than that.
It's much more complicated than that. And again, that comes back to the mixed congregation as well. Even those in churches, as you say, with been long evangelical heritage, there's no saying that if the vicar were to say, I think I need to leave in all good conscience, that the rest of the congregation would go with him. Some might, many wouldn't.
Yeah, okay.
Who's then going to minister to those, okay, and so on?
Last couple of minutes, and it is the last couple of minutes. How can I encourage my local ministry mate? You know, I'm thinking, it feels a bit like, you know, just don't mention the war. But actually, that's not how I would approach any other pastoral situation in church.
No.
So how do I encourage someone who is bruised and battered and feeling torn about it all?
So let them know that you're praying for him. Yeah. In particular, maybe around the times of General Synod, around the times where those debates are happening, just, you know, a quick text, say, just, you know, seeing some of the stuff that's happening on the news, praying for you, because I know this must be really hard. You know, if he wants to talk, you know, would you like to go out for a beer, mate, or, you know, go for a coffee or whatever? You know, how are you bearing up under this? Just being pastoral to the pastor.
Go out for sherry. I thought it was going to be.
If a bishop were doing his bishoping job of pastoring the pastors, that would be fabulous. Yeah. But in the best, you know, will and well, that's probably not happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So your pastor, you know, your local evangelical vicar may well love just someone who says, look, just, you know, it won't go any further, but if you need someone to just sound off about.
Which, interesting, we've been thinking here about listening.
Yes.
And good listening and the power of good listening. Mm. And actually that applies, you know, we've been thinking about it in terms of pastoral relationships, but it's equally true in terms of, well, any relationship, peer-to-peer relationships.
Yeah.
We can be good listeners, can't we?
Exactly.
I can be a good listener to my ministry mates, and I should be.
And to have someone outside of the congregation can often be very valuable in that.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say, most vicars, you know, they desperately want to get on with evangelism and discipleship. Mm. They don't want to spend all their time thinking about this issue. So if you can find any ways to encourage them in that, to do evangelism together or whatever it is, you know, or just, you know, let's chat about how are you going to use Easter this year and what might we, you know, or whatever it is, just encourage him in normal ministry or her in normal everyday ministry, because that's what they will really want to be focusing on anyway.
That's something that everyone can do. Roz, thank you so much. I hope we haven't lost too many of you. I mean, at one level, it's fascinating. Another level, it's depressing. Another level, we think, actually, the gospel is bigger than all of this.
Absolutely.
And that's our great hope, isn't it? That the power of the gospel to transform lives is unchanged and cannot be diminished by these things that are going on.
If people do want to understand a bit more about this, we have a series of five recent episodes of the Church Society podcast. What is the Church of England? How does it work? How does it change? What's gone wrong? Those kind of questions. So there's a bit more detail on that.
Ross, thanks so much for joining us. This has been Independence. Thank you for being with us. If you've enjoyed the podcast, do rate and review. It helps other people find us, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you so much for having me.